Hello and welcome to episode 13 of Destroy Before Listening, which is a conversation between myself, Pete Byrne and Veek Martin. The Veek or Vic pronunciation dependent on when or where you met her. The path from being a young zine maker in the early part of the 90s eventually led her to move to America and work at Revelation Records in Southern California. She left that position after 20 years fairly recently to a new home with Pirate Press Records, who released mainly street punk and oi artists, as well as being a broker for record pressing in the US. Starting in Brighton, Veek moved around the UK, turning her Simba zine into a record label and distribution as well. I remember ordering records and Simba zines regularly around 96-97 because she always had a great selection at this time. The first record released was in 1994, and since then stuff was put out by groups such as Greyhouse, Texas Is The Reason, Ink & Dagger, Danko Jones and a number of Swedish groups. The label restarted in the 2010s, releasing mainly Louisville bands like Endpoint, Elliot and By The Grace Of God. Veek also promoted tours and drove bands around before leaving the UK for Rev in 1998. She also talks about that experience here. Her early reading about feminism put her on a path towards being able to deal with the heavily male-dominated hardcore scene. She has been putting together a book entitled Chicks Up Front about women in hardcore in the 90s, which should see publication next year. Her first book was a collection of work originally published in the Simba zine. Listen past the end track if you want to hear another Rev story and about her work as a herbalist with Punk Potions. Please follow on Instagram, at DestroyBeforeListening, where photos are posted relating to each episode. You can listen via any usual podcast platforms. Please subscribe, leave a review, or share this to anyone who may be interested. Getting the word out is always appreciated. Thank you. Would I be right in thinking that you or your hometown is Brighton?
It is, yeah.
Okay. Growing up in Brighton, basically, like your early memories of sort of what led you into the world of punk rock, hardcore?
So I was led into the world of punk and hardcore by having a crush on a boy and checking out the bands that he wore T-shirts of. Mm-hmm. And I went to London and bought records by Descendants, Youth of Today, Minor Threat and Black Flag, and went home and listened to them and became intrigued and, you know, did the normal thing of thanks lists, looking at thanks lists on records, buying other records on those labels. And then I moved to London to go to university. So I went to my first shows were in Brighton in the summer of 89, and then I moved to London. And obviously there were even more shows there. And I got involved in the street edge scene in London, lived in London for 3 years, moved back to Brighton, did a master's degree at Sussex University and started traveling to the East Coast, going to shows, staying with people I'd met through doing a zine. And then when I was 23, my mom died. And I needed to get out of Brighton because it was not a great situation for me. And one of my friends was moving to Manchester to do a master's. So I left with her, lived in Manchester for a year, became really involved in the punk hardcore scene in Leeds because there really wasn't one much in Manchester in 95. And just spent all my time driving to Leeds. So was like, well, this is stupid. So moved to Leeds, lived in Leeds for 2 years. That's when the label got bigger and I started booking tours and I was running Revelation Europe. And then I found it all pretty stressful. And I realized that it was not good for me to be my own boss. I was one of those people that worked like 14 hours a day and then like my skin was falling off my face in food allergies, which was stress induced. Yeah. So I decided that it was best for me not to be my own boss because I couldn't really balance work and home life. And I felt like my time in the North was kind of, coming to an end to some degree. All my friends were graduating Leeds Uni, and it was just kind of changing up there. And I was offered the job of running Southern. John Loder offered me that job, and I thought that that would be a really good change in life. And so I was planning on doing that. And then I was visiting Jordan at Revelation in California, and he offered me the job of running Rev. And I was like, oh, that's a difficult decision. Because, you know, Discord versus Revelation, it's not an easy choice. But Huntington Beach won over Tottenham. That was a clear deciding factor. The sunny blue skies. And I thought it would only be for a couple of years. But I've been living in America for 23 years now. So clearly, it was not just for a couple of years.
No.
And yeah, that's how I ended up living in the States. I actually became a citizen 3 weeks ago, which was really, really weird.
Well, that's like the, I suppose, a later part of history, a short here to there. But yeah. just to go back to Brighton again, would it be the feminism and like reading be an influence before punk rock? So that mindset of the like the personal
absolutely
personal, I mean, being political is yeah. an influence upon,
well, I mean, I became a feminist when I was 12.
Okay.
I've always been a really, like, when I was a kid, my head was just always buried in a book. When I was four, I had a reading age of a 12-year-old.
Okay.
I was a bit of a nutty kid that just devoured chapter books at like 5 years old. And when I was 12, I discovered the feminist section of a bookstore and thought it looked interesting and bought a few books and never looked back. And I'd always struggled with music because I felt like it didn't, like the lyrics didn't have any meaning for me. And when I discovered Billy Bragg at 15, I felt like I'd found my world. And then I discovered, I think, Crass when I was, and Devo, and then Crass, and then Conflict, and, you know, a bunch of bands of that genre. But I loved the politics and the lyrics of Crass, but didn't, like, the music just didn't do it for me. And then when I discovered, I don't know, Fugazi, I was like, oh, this is where I belong.
So was that, sorry, was that like your, what age?
18. I saw Fugazi 18. On their first European tour. I was 18.
Cool,
and I cried.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely felt like the tie of feminism into punk. But I also, when then I became involved in punk, I became very aware of all of the you know, all the double standards, all of the misogyny that was present in mainstream culture, which still is, was also present in punk. So as a much more of a minority at shows back in the 80s and the early 90s, I fought really hard to try and be a voice against that.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask about that because punk, the hardcore, that's predominantly like male dominated.
Oh, yeah, it is.
I can't imagine. But like, how does that look to, you know, a woman?
Well,
how does that hold that vibe of that energy, which is mainly like a testosterone, like male energy thing?
Well, I think most of the women that gravitate towards punk also have a lot of anger.
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of women have a lot of anger, and a lot of women can't express that. You know, we're taught not to be angry. We're taught to bury it. We're taught to just smile and push those emotions down. You know, it's misogyny and patriarchy is, it's not just toxic for men in terms of burying certain aspects of their emotions and expression. It's toxic for women as well. There are feelings and expressions that are taboo for us. You know, and in mainstream culture specifically, mainstream Western culture. But within punk, it's socially acceptable, you know, to go into a show and scream on the top of your lungs and have an outlet for that, for that anger, even when we're full of estrogen. And my friends were all spread all over the world that felt the same as me, but we, you know, we had a gang, Chicks Up Front, and we saw each other when we could, and we wrote letters and we made zines and we talked on the phone, and when we could, we went to shows together. And it was infinitely better going to a show with a girl or a bunch of girls than just being the only girl there. I definitely, the first time that happened for me was the spring of 93 on my first trip to the East Coast. And that was life-changing. And that was, I think, you know, one of the reasons that I gravitated towards staying in the States, because there was a lot of female friends that I had here that went to shows.
Yeah. What about the influence of Riot Girl as well in the early 90s?
So when I first went to DC, it was March of 93. So it was kind of like two-thirds of the way through. If you take like the window of Riot Girl, you know, I mean, it's like, it was mainly like a 3-4 year window of where it was really active. And some of my friends who were involved in Chicks Up Front were also Riot Girls. And I read all of their zines, and I appreciated and really valued a lot of their politics. But there was no band that you would consider in the Riot Girl genre ever appealed to me. I found a lot of them.
Was it more like Nation of Ulysses or like, well, it was, I remember it was always like the Discord sounding bands that you...
Yeah, I loved Discord sort of stuff, but I also loved, you know, at the time I loved a lot of stuff on Revelation. I liked, I mean, it depends which year we're in, you know, are we in 93 or are we in 95? You know, my taste changed a lot over those mid 90s. But, mm-hmm. and it's also really hard looking back because I can remember really loving a lot of the bands on Revelation in that era. But because of working at Revelation for 20 years, my perspective is definitely skewed because, you know, those bands that I loved in 93 became catalog numbers and my job. And people that I wrote royalty checks to, and some people that were fantastic and some people that were assholes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then all as the years passed, you know, I was a big part of the Rev 25 shows and the Rev 30 shows. And so, you know, it's like how I think of a band, how I thought of a band when I was, you know, 22, 23 is very different to how I think of a band more than 25 years later, partly because there's, you know, there's revisionist history and it's very hard to be objective about something that you've had, that's been such a big part of your life. Whereas all of the Discord bands like Three and Rites of Spring and Embrace and mm-hmm. you know, those bands, they've not had anything, you know, not with them never doing reunions, with them never playing shows again, and with most of those people not even doing newer bands other than that, you know, that I've worked with. Excuse me. There's been nothing to like mar the memories. So I do think of those with, you know, they have a little like rose tinted glow around them.
Well, that Three album, fuck it, that's a fantastic record. That, like, I was listening to that again, like recently.
The Three album, you know, is just, it's amazing.
That Embrace, Rites of Spring, it's just like, I think the Three album is probably, I don't know, I would maybe say it's the better one now. I mean, I wouldn't have.
I know. The first time I met Ian MacKaye properly was maybe 10 years ago, which was strange because we have a lot of mutual friends. And he gave me like the tour of the house, but we actually had an argument.
That sounds about right, doesn't it? Most people seem to get an argument, or he seems to argue.
He's a very opinionated man. He's a very opinionated man. And we were standing there talking, and he was talking about 7 Seconds, and he was talking about their first EPs, and I spoke up and said that my favorite 7 Seconds record is Soul Force Revolution. And he looked at me and he said, "You're wrong." In some situations, there is a right and a wrong, and you're wrong. And then we got into this like total argument about how you can't be right and wrong about art. You can't be right or wrong about music, and it's all about personal preference. But my response to him was, "Well, my favorite record on Discord is the Three
the
album."
The argument.
I was like, "My favorite record on Discord is the Three album. Yeah. How does that balance in the right and wrong?" And then I'm like standing there and I'm like, "Oh my God, I can't believe I just said that to him, Mackay. Oh my God, oh my God." But he thought it was hilarious. And then I started backtracking and I was like, "Well, I don't know if I can say that because, you know, Rites of Spring, blah, blah, blah." And then when he's giving me the tour of the Discord house, he gave me the three reels to hold, and he posed for a photo with them, which was pretty cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice to hold a piece of history like that.
Yeah. Because he's sort of like a janitor or something there now, isn't he? He's like a major archivist of like every receipt for every meal he had like 40 years ago or something.
Yeah, it's very, very organized there. And having worked at Revelation for such a long time and, you know, worked and been to many other labels, it was beautiful to see the organization and the way that than the preservation of the legacy that is Discord and how seriously that's been taken. I really like that.
Yeah. Well, to get the timeline, it would be the zine that came first then.
Simba zine. I remember banging out the first issue in my last year at university. So that was in 1992.
Okay.
My boyfriend at the time, Tony Sylvester, who's now the singer of Turbo Negro.
Yeah.
He was in Fabric and a bunch of other bands. He did some of the interviews with me. So he was like he started it with me. And then I kind of, you know, because he'd done a zine before and we lived together and it made sense at the time. And then, but it was all mine. He was, you know, a contributor. And it was, it just networked me with so many people. You know, once you start doing a zine and you do zine trades and you start talking to people all over the world, and then they want to carry your zine. And it led to so many things. I mean, it was featured in Melody Maker a couple of years later when they did a feature on zines. I was quoted by Jermaine Greer in her book.
Were you?
Fucking Dennis from Refused wore a Simba t-shirt in the insert to Shape of Punk to Fan the Flame.
I see.
And I didn't know Refused and I didn't care, but you know, there's the singer of the band wearing my t-shirt in their album for Songs to Fan the Flame. And so I went to their show and I'd just done my newest issue. So I went to their show and to give him a copy of the new issue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it just like the zine led me to places that I would have never gone to if I'd never, you know, I don't know what my life would be like if I had never done it. It's a strange, strange thing. And they're talking right now about the new punk rock museum in LA, in Vegas, that's being built, and they're considering my zine. And you know, I got asked to be in to write the liner notes for the Spitboy album, and it's me and Billy Joe Armstrong, and it's just like, well, that's weird. I was in like Rolling Stone, my name was next to him, and you know, it's just, but Spitboy were one of the first bands I interviewed, so that's one of the reasons they asked me to do it. But it's just strange, the places that it's led for what I consider, you know, a smallish zine. I mean, the most I ever printed of each issue was 2,000.
It's still a lot of anything to get about, isn't it?
And then the issue that was about my mum dying when I was 23, I made 1,000 of that one, and there wasn't a single band in it. And that's when I realized that what I was writing about and what I was saying mattered to people. And the amount of mail I got of people identifying with things that I wrote about and thanking me for my openness. And wanting to have a dialogue about important life things rather than talking about fluff was really fun. I mean, you know, God, I would get like 50 letters a week. It was nuts in the mid-90s, but you know, I loved it, and I hope that, you know, it had an impact on people. Been nowhere near the impact it's had on my life, but you know, I hope that it made a difference in people's lives, and I hope that it continues to, because, you know, I did a collection of all the zines about 9 years ago and published it as a book. Mm-hmm. And you know, that in itself is just, you know, available, and people, it still sells, it trickles out of all the distributors and Amazon, and you know, I'm really proud of it. And I'm working on a second book at the moment, yeah, which is the history of Chicks Up Front and straight edge women in the 90s and 80s.
Okay.
But I've done all the interviews for it. I just have to sit down and write it now, which was going to be last year, but with fucking COVID, I did not feel creative. And I felt like if I sat and wrote, that I was in, you know, that the feelings of despair and anxiety that were brought up for everybody during COVID,
yep,
would kind of seep into the writing, which I didn't, and mm-hmm, I didn't want it to be, you know, contaminated. I wanted it, yeah, to be, I wanted it to be, have its fair.
That's where, sorry, when I've been doing this, it pushed people in different ways.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people went digging around, didn't they, and like posting flyers and,
yeah,
memories and, you know.
Yeah, and a lot of people were doing that thing where they were like cleaning out their house.
Yeah.
Because they had time, and so they were like going through old photos.
Yeah, and you come across all these originals of things that you thought were lost, and
yeah.
You know,
I was working full time, and then I was making masks 40, 50 hours a week on top of that last spring. So that, okay, took up, yeah. I was working 9 to 5 and then sewing 6 till 11. I made nearly 3,000 masks.
It's no time to do a book then, is it really?
No,
to
get fit, it wasn't.
Squeeze writing a book in. Couldn't
keeping
do that.
People alive was more important, it felt like. And then, yeah, then I had a sick cat, and then... then it was Christmas, and then I got a puppy, and there's always, okay, a reason. But I am hoping this fall I will be able to like knuckle down and,
yeah,
you know. But you,
how does, well, with regard to the kind of publishing aspect, the, well, going from thinking about a book and like formatting of a book to how you started out doing,
gosh, yeah,
the zine, how does, well, that like translate, what's the transit, how does that, you know, what does that look like now when you think about it?
So when I did the zine, it was all rip and paste, and that's how I like to do layout. So when I did the collection of zines, I laid the entire book out as if I was as if I was just going to go get it offset printed from the flats, but right, obviously it's all digital now, so that couldn't happen. Mm-hmm. So then, and you can't scan in text and get a good representation of it. So, yeah, my good friend Jim, I sent him all of the backdrops, and then he had to fit text into blank blobbies templates. And it was an absolute nightmare of a layout job for that poor person. But with the book, I'm just going to write chapters. I'm going to collect all the photos, and then I'm going to send them to him and be like, go crazy. Mm-hmm. He gets to be as creative as he wants. And then I'm not really fussy about what books look like in general. So I'm going to give him the creativity to do that. But I don't know who's going to publish it. I might put it out on Simba. It might come out on the same publisher who did the Simba book, Vitriol, owned, yeah, by Justin Smith. I don't think he's put a book out in a while, so I don't know if he's still doing them. But, you know, it's one of those things where, do I want to put it out myself, or do I want somebody else to do it? it's a hard decision, but after working at Revelation for so many years, I edited the Burning Fight book by Brian Peterson, and I handled all the distribution on that for him when I was the sales manager at Rev. So, you know, I know all of the steps to jump through. I know people at book distributors, and I don't know whether I want to do the work or whether I want to just hand it off to somebody else, because it's hard when it's your baby, you know, you take everything personally. If someone says, no, I don't want to carry that, you're like, where? But why? Whereas when it's a project you're just working, it's easier. Yeah. It's a fair way from being at that point, but at some point I'm going to need to figure out who am I going to have put this out, who am I going to have distribute it. But yeah, that's the fun stuff. I mean, I've been doing this work for 25 years. I enjoy the nuts and bolts, printing, pressing, distribution, writing one sheets, social media, marketing, all of that, all of that stuff is my day-to-day life. So it definitely gives me an advantage when it comes to my own projects.
Well, I guess you did the zine first, and then how was it, like, maybe a year, what, 2 years would it be till putting
it was about two years. It was 94, I think. No, 95, yeah. I put my first record out.
Okay.
And, that just came from, well, why not? I know how, I'd established, at that point, 2 years later, I had established, like, a little distro from trading zines. And then some people wanted to carry my zine, but only put records out. So they would swap records for zines. So I had a couple of shoe boxes under my bed that were all the zines and the 7 inches I was carrying in my little distro. And so it just seemed to make sense to start a label. And I think I've done 26 releases in, that would be 26 years.
That's not bad. It's okay.
It's not bad, but I did probably 20 of them. I did probably 10 of them in the first 5 years. And then I didn't put anything out after I moved to America for a while because I was broke.
Yeah, there's a hiatus.
And then I do them now when I'm passionate about a record and I'm like, why isn't this on vinyl? Yeah. And somebody will be like, I don't know. And I was like, would you want to press it? I'll put it out in Simba. We'll make 500. And they're like, yeah, sounds cool. But then getting that person to like finish some artwork and pull all the masters together is like getting blood from a stone sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think I have like 6 records I've been working on for 2 years. Okay. And the people are just useless. And so I just kind of give up.
The first release being Fabric and Grey House.
Yes.
It's a Fabric, a split 7-inch.
Yes.
So how and why really? When did it start?
They were my two favourite bands at the time.
Yeah.
And the guys in Fabric loved the guys in Grey House. They loved Grey House, rather. They loved Grey House as a band. And then the guys in Grey House thought Fabric seemed pretty cool. And so Grey House hadn't had much come out. They'd only done a couple of 7 inches. And so this seat, and they did another split 7-inch on Trouble Man at the same time with Dahlia Seed. So this was like 2 songs from a session. One went on mine and one went on Mike Simonetti's record. And it came out great. I was really happy with it. They sold really well. And then I did the Samuel Texas Is the Reason split, and that went nuts.
Yeah.
Because I pressed 1,000 of the Fabric Grey House, but I did 5,000 of the Samuel Texas.
So is that 96 then, like a year, sort of within a year?
Yeah.
Well, it would have been when Texas Is the Reason was sort of really
when they first started. That was their first release, actually.
Yeah.
Same time as the Rev 7-inch. It's funny because we talk about repressing that for Record Store Day on colored vinyl. And Eric Astor, who ran Art Monk Construction, who owns Furnace Pressing and was a drummer of Samuel, he found all the parts like a year ago. And that's one of those other releases where I'm like, yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that. And then nothing happens. It just, you know, the bands have to be motivated when it comes to shit like that. And it's hard getting people to, it's hard getting old people to prioritize something they did 25 years ago, because they're just like, yeah, that's cool. And then they just get, they're busy with their regular lives and nothing happens.
Yeah. So approximately the label runs sort of to the late 90s and then kind of like there's a bit, a few releases when you're in America and then it stops and then it comes back again, doesn't it? Like last decade.
Yes. And then when I just started doing Record Store Day limited edition releases. Yeah.
Is that what all these, the, oh, sorry, there's four releases, isn't there? There's,
cause yeah, the
Grey House.
Yeah. Yeah, Endpoint, Elliot, Grey House, and Suede Head.
Right.
Yep, and By the Grace of God, five records.
By the Grace of God,
By the Grace of God was the only record that I didn't do production on. It was a weird one. It was like a split release with State of Mind, and it was going to be on Simba, but then they didn't get it together for like another 5 years, I would say. By the time, like we discussed it coming out on Simba when I was doing the book tour for the Simba book, because they played I did a spoken word and they played in Miami. And so that would have been in 2013. And I don't think that record came out till 2017, maybe.
Right.
So by the time it came out, I was broke. And State of Mind really wanted to put it out, so we were just like, well, how about it's a split release? And they were like, well, how much, you know, what do you want for it? And I was like, yeah, just give it this catalog number and put my logo on it. Okay. that's all I want for it, and I'll help with the promotion, like, because it's just too split releases can be so complicated, especially when both labels have like different distribution channels, because you can't have you can't have the same release go through two different exclusive distributors. It doesn't work like that. You know, you just have to pick one channel. So it was just easiest for me to let him handle everything. So sometimes, didn't mean to forget, By the Grace of God. Fucking love those dudes.
I was
happy to be involved in it.
How did, there's like three Louisville bands.
Yeah, so Elliot were on Revelation, and I became really close with those guys. And then Christensen were also on Revelation and became very close with those guys as well. So since, 2000, I've been going to Louisville regularly. Like some of my closest friends still live there. Some of them have moved away, but I'm still really close with Chris Higdon, the singer of Elliot, and Robbie Scott and Brad from Christensen. So I've got a trip booked to Louisville in October. Pre-COVID, I probably went twice a year. Like everyone's got kids now, and if you don't go regularly, you know the kids, you know, forget you, and you lose those, you know, those relationships are hard to maintain unless you go visit regularly. It's my, it's kind of my second home in America, I feel like.
It does seem pretty separate to like a lot, like the bands and the music coming out of there.
Yeah.
It's always it's always a very different thing.
It's a special scene there. Yeah. It really is. It's a special community, and it's not like one of those special communities that was, where hardcore and punk were really big for a few years and it exploded and then died. It's just been like steady for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And it's people in Louisville, they understood. I mean, it's kind of similar to DC in some ways. There's a really great community there that's obviously been there for a long time, but they kind of, it's a very insular community, I would say. You know, people who live in one of those in Louisville tend to stay in Louisville for the most part. Yeah. And you know, they've all been doing bands with each other on and off for a very long time, and it's lovely. I love it. You're making me homesick for a place I've never lived.
Well, to go back to, well, let's go back again, when did you book tours, European tours for bands? Because I remember Locust and Jenny Piccolo
yes
being so your Well, you had a hand in that, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
It's a really good question, and it's a bit, I'm going to be honest with you, it's a little hazy.
Yeah.
It started with becoming friends with the Swing Kids, who've always been one of my absolute favorite bands. So Marco from Avocado booked their tour, and I went to a few shows, and then I went to like Manchester, Glasgow, Bradford. And then it was a few days later was Ypres Fest. So we would be talking 97 here. A few days later was Ypres Fest, but Jose, the drummer of Swing Kids, left his cymbals at the 1 in 12 club. So I went and picked them up, and instead of driving to Ypres, I went like 3 days earlier and I drove them to some town in Germany.
Yeah.
And
this is Swing Kids. So
yes,
you had involvement in Swing Kids and like local, you at that end of like.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I became really good friends with Justin Pearson because of the Swing and Eric Allen with the Swing Kids connection, and then. And it was nuts because I arrived at their Germany show with their cymbals as they were about to go on stage, and their driver had left them in the middle of Germany that day. So I packed them all into my car and drove them to their remaining shows and then back to England for their last show. So I was kind of they were a little bit stoked that I'd just shown up. And it was, you know, pre-cell phones, pre-even really anyone having email, you know, so they had no idea I was going to like turn up and fucking, as it were, save the day. Yeah. I'm packing four boys and all their guitars in my car was challenging, but we did it. Guitars on your laps, lads. And so, yeah, I became really good friends with Justin, and Marco from Avocado wanted to book the Locust tour. And I decided, well, yeah, I can book the English shows. I mean, I knew a bunch of people who put on shows. And so that's when I started booking shows. I just started like, you know, finding, you know, you can ask anyone, do you know anyone who puts on shows? And, you know, if you know the person who puts on shows in Leeds, then they're likely to know the person who puts on shows in Manchester, for example.
Yeah. They played in Newcastle.
They did.
That was a show, was that?
And I think Lynn's put that show on.
I think, yeah, he probably would have.
And we put most of my tours on. So basically Marco would bring over a band or I would bring over a band, and Marco would book mainland Europe. Dennis from Refused would book Scandinavia, and I would book the UK. And we did that for about 12 tours, I would guess. And then I started booking for other booking agents, so I did like the Promise Ring for a different agent, and I charged $10 a show, or $10 a tour, depending on how much I liked the band. I was very minimal. I didn't work with guarantees. I expected a t-shirt and like $10 for my phone bill. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't $10 a show. It was $10 a tour. Or £10 a tour. I was put the lead show on myself or Bradford, and it was fun. I had a blast doing it. But the Locust Jenny Piccolo tour, 3 days before, the driver cancelled. So rented a van and I drove them myself. And it was a fucking nightmare, but also fucking brilliant. And then, you know, I guess it just got harder and harder to do that when Marco was making it like his full-time job, and it wasn't a full-time job for me, and Marco, you know, became like a serious booking agent, as he is still is now, with a fantastic company, and I highly respect what he's done over the last 25 years. But booking tours is a really fucking stressful thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's a thankless job, and like most things in the music industry, it's very stressful. You know, if a tour does well, it's because the band are great, not because you booked a good tour. Same way as if you do publicity on a record or sales on a record, it's the record always or the band get the glory. But if it doesn't do well, it's because you did a shit job.
Yeah. So did this put you in a good sort of position to just think, oh, well, fuck it, I can be production manager at Revelation. I've got all this stuff. I've got all these sort of skills behind.
Yeah, I mean, I had the label, I had the distro.
Yeah.
I done production a whole bunch. I did publicity on my own releases. But yeah, Jordan had called me and said that he was having a bunch of problems and would I come over and help try and fix them? So right. I went over, I think, in the spring of 98 and tried to help him fix all the problems. And that's when he was just like, I wish you could be here all the time. And I said, well, I can't because of visas. And he said, well, what if we talk to a lawyer and try to get you a visa and sponsorship? And I was just like, sure, completely not expecting that to happen. And it did. And when I first started at Revelation, it was very strange because I was hired as the label manager, but most staff don't take kindly to someone being brought in and hired over them.
Yeah.
So there, especially when that person has a vagina and practically everybody else in the building does not. And there was a lot of friction.
Especially, I suppose you're just coming over it. Well, yeah. You know, you're foreign to the whole situation.
But it's also that I think that a lot of the time when an owner of a company finds managing their business overwhelming because it has grown to more than they can handle there's not enough hours in the day to handle their workload. So they hire somebody to help with that workload, but that person can't read their mind. And that person has their own way of doing things and their own thoughts and feelings on the best way of doing things and their own experiences. So there's always friction. And I would definitely say that, you know, at 27, I was way more stubborn than I am now. Yeah. And I was also not in a good place because my father died 6 weeks before I moved to the States.
Right.
So I was not in a good place myself. So we had some friction, and then I basically switched roles and became kind of half label manager, half just doing foreign sales.
Yeah.
But then over the years, that completely changed, and the publicist would leave, and I would do their job and then hire and train the next publicist. Same with accounting. There were windows when I did the accounting for like 2 years in the early 2000s, and then 10 years at the end. And then there were windows where we didn't have an A&R person for a month, 2 years, 6 months. And so I would take over the A&R position. So, and then I took over production in 2004 permanently.
Okay.
So yeah, I wore a lot of different hats there and
The first 5 years is pretty kind of up and down until you settle into it.
And then it settled down into, as I became saner, I think.
Okay.
I think it settled into like a really good, and the early 2000s was a fantastic period of time with so many music festivals, the hardcore scene and post-hardcore scene and indie rock scene just thriving. I mean, I remember one year I was just like, you know, I was at Crazy Fest and Hellfest and gosh, there was a fest in Vermont. There was a fest in Florida. There was PopCom in Germany, Midem in France. I mean, you know, I was always somewhere different with different people doing stuff, representing the label, hanging out with our bands. And it was a great time. It was, you know, a brilliant time for my early 30s. I really look back on that era as my favorite time at the label. But then, you know, file sharing happened, CDs started dying. This was before the vinyl resurgence and downloads. And it was, you know, over the last 20 years, the music world has done nothing but shrink in terms of revenue for bands and for labels. So it's definitely become much harder to find a niche in a way that is sustainable.
But again, to Revelation, what is the role of the production? Is this how it leads into your next sort of job, which is Pirates Press, which is more, it's a hands-on sort of mechanics of a
record?
No, not really.
Okay. At Revelation, production was, you know, everything from pressing a new record, dealing with the artwork, the master, and sending it off to be pressed, to just repressing all of the classics. And so it would be every 2 weeks run a report, look at stock. How many Gorilla Biscuits albums do we have in stock? 326. What's the turnaround time right now? 4 months. How many do we sell a month? Yeah, we need to repress it. Place another order. You know, when it was black vinyl, I would just place the orders. If it was a repress on color, which was for some of the records and not others, then I would send Jordan a list of these are the colors we've done this on before. What color would you like to do it on next? And sometimes he would write back, I don't care, pick one. And other times he would have a very specific idea. And so, you know, it was fun. It was like fun to choose what color to press the Inside Out 7-inch on. You know, that never got old. I enjoyed doing that part of my job. It's also a stressful job. The only time I ever cried from stress at Revelation was when the Elliot print for Song in the Air arrived, and we pressed 20,000 CDs of that, and the print got delivered, and it was on gloss, not matte paper. And I knew the band would be furious and that they wouldn't accept it, and the whole world. And I cannot tell you how hard my heart was beating as I looked up my email to the printer with the instructions. But I hadn't made the mistake. Yeah. The printer had made the mistake, and it got redone. But, you know, there were tears because it was like, no, we're going to miss the street date because it would have to be redone. But at least it wasn't my mistake. So, you know, production is stressful. You are the last point of
check
quality control. Yeah. And is this, you know, you get the proofs. Is this correct? But transitioning to Pirates Press, So Pirates Press is two companies. It's Pirates Press, the broker. We're a pressing plant broker. We also make CDs and cassettes. We're known for our vinyl. It's the majority of our business, but we also have a merchandise company as well and can make, you know, t-shirts, stickers, everything you could possibly ever need as a label or a band or any business, really. And Pirates Press Records is basically the owner's passion project, where he puts out records for bands that he loves and his friends' bands. And that was an exclusive label at Revelation for the 13 years or so, 11 years, I don't remember now, that it had been a label. We took them on very, very early on, you know, when they'd done less than 10 releases, because Skippy was a friend of a friend of mine. And my last year at Revelation, so 2018, Pirates Press Records started to grow massively. And I was on the phone with Skippy one day, and he was talking about, because he's running the pressing plant reps and side of things, as well as all of pressing all the records for the labels that are his direct accounts, he does a huge amount of work on a daily basis. And he was talking about how he thought he might need to hire a label manager. And I was feeling like my time at Rev needed to end for various reasons. And so when I fully decided that in November of 2018, Skippy was my first phone call. And I said, he would have been an early phone call anyway, because they were an exclusive label at Rev. I would have wanted him to know. And they were our they were Rev's biggest fully exclusive label. So it was a really big relationship that they had, we had. So I called Skippy and he said, he said that if I wanted to write up a proposal and come up and meet the rest of the staff, that he thought that that would be a really great fit. So I don't actually work on the production side of things for the pressing plant brokerage.
Is that based in San Francisco and you're...
It's based in Oakland, yeah. I mean, both companies are based in Oakland.
Right.
And I'm still in Long Beach. But
right.
I think there's 26 people that work for the pressing plant brokerage.
Yeah.
And probably about, I'd have to count, but probably about 15 of them live in Oakland. So there's a few that work remotely and a few that work, and then a whole office in the Czech Republic where GZ Records, our pressing plant, is based. And then there's four people that work for the label, including me, but only one is in the warehouse. And then the other two are in New Jersey. So it's not a big deal that I work remotely. And it's better than the guys who work in New Jersey, because at least I'm on the same time zone as Skippy. So that's helpful. And pre-COVID, I would go up for 4 or 5 days every other month. So I solely work on the label side of things, but I do the production on all of our band's t-shirts for their tours and for the web store. And I'm actually learning right now, Skippy's training me to do the production on all of our label releases for vinyl.
Describe the stuff you're putting out, it's more, well, would you say like oi or street punk?
Punk and oi on the label. That's Skippy's genre of choice, as it were. But then there's a lot of stuff over the last few years that isn't. I mean, we have Subhumans. We're about to reissue all of their back catalog.
Okay.
We have the Aguilites and the Slackers, who are reggae. Barstool Preachers, who are kind of hard to pigeonhole. They're a little street punk, a little pop punk, a little ska, a little reggae, a little unique. And, you know, we don't just have, you know, small street punk bands. We've got fucking Coxsparrow. You know, they're our biggest band on the label and always will be.
I was wondering about how you should say that, like Coxsparrow.
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 I don't think you could say it with a northern accent and have it sound right.
Not really. I just thought, I was watching something the other day and it was the kind of like Mary Poppins style, you know, like Cockney style. And it's just
it has
fucking
to be said like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Then this year... This year, we're starting to put out bands that I brought to the label, which is really exciting.
Okay.
So, Pirates Press Records is definitely a team effort. And if one of the members of staff, including the people that work at the pressing plant side of things, they often bring bands to the label. Somebody will bring a band to us. We all have like a group email about it. Everybody checks them out and then we make a decision as a group. But Skippy's really open-minded, and if it's not his cup of tea, but it has a lot of potential and somebody at the label is passionate about it, then, most of the time he'll be like, yeah, let's do this. So yeah, we just put out a 12-inch by this woman called Susie Moon. That we pressed 500 and it sold out the week of Street Date, which was really exciting. But now we've got to wait till September for the repress, but she's one of mine. And then we're about to put out later this year, the album, Justin Smith from Vitriol, his new band Sweat, which are an amazing hardcore band with a female singer. And they sound a bit like kind of more like older San Diego stuff, like Hot Snakes.
Okay.
But definitely a hardcore band. They're fucking great. They've got a single out on Vitriol right now. It's on like Bandcamp and Spotify. You can check it out. But yeah, I really like them. And it just makes me really happy to be bringing this diversity to Pirates Press Records roster, because, you know, all boys is boring.
Yeah. After all the decades you've put in now, is what keeps you kind of motivated to, you know, still continue on?
People being lovely.
Okay.
It's really basic, but just like being fucking appreciated. Like the woman that we put out a record for in April, Susie Moon, like she's so passionate and excited and she works so hard, and just like helping her achieve her goals makes me happy. Like whether it's like selling out of the first press of the vinyl, or right now we're working on a tour routing, and just like getting new material by one of our bands is just really fucking exciting. We've got new material that just came in from Grade 2, Bastille Preachers and The Drowns. Just listening to it, you know, and you get a buzz of like, I'm listening to this and I'm probably like the fourth person in the world other than the band, or sometimes the first person in the world other than the bands and the people who recorded it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's definitely a buzz on that. And then like, you know, talking to the band about touring and talking to a record store who are really excited about a release you put out. But like when people are nice and appreciative and respectful and excited and passionate, it makes me enthusiastic. I mean, there's not many jobs that you have that, you know, music changes people's lives, and that will never, you know, I feel like maybe the person hearing the next Bastille Preachers record, that's going to change their life as much as any random record I heard when I was 18. Okay. And I feel like that's still important, and I still feel fucking passionate about that. And I still feel like, you know, punk records are fucking important for the next generation of children. And as well as for all of us who are, you know, old farts who still get excited about new music, and have a lot of friends who don't check out new music. That's fine. You know, you listen to the music from when you were 15. Do you, boo. I'm fine with that. But I, you know, I fucking love new songs, new records. You know, Off With Their Heads' last album got me through COVID. You know, I don't know how I would have got through. The last Bronx album, the demos, got me through losing my cat. You know, like music uplifts you. Music gets you through really shitty times. And without people on the back end doing the shit I do, that music doesn't make it to the listener. It's that simple. And the, you know, in some ways it feels like some days you feel like what you do doesn't matter, no matter what you do, and I might as well be selling fucking cans of baked beans.
Yeah.
But then other days when you get like a random message from some kid who bought a record, or some post on Instagram, and it reminds you, and it just like brings you back to a time when you were 15 and you got that record that changed your life. And as well as doing all I can to help the bands move with their momentum and to change their lives. You know, it's the goal with any band on the label that the band gets successful enough that they can quit their day jobs. That's my only goal. A lot of our bands would love to not have to work a day job. And if I can help them make enough revenue touring and streaming and selling records, then I consider that it's a day's work well done, you know?
You're looking down, see you going down.
One last thing, I was just going to, you know, just an aside, is like your the punk potions, if you'd like to speak a bit about the...
That's cool.
Talk about punk potions.
Yeah, I became a herbalist about 6 years ago. I did an apprenticeship and then an advanced apprenticeship. And one of the things they encourage you to do, one of the things you learn to do when you're a herbalist, is to make medicine, make herbal medicine. And so you have to come up with a name for your company. And when I came up with Punk Potions, you know, it's kind of like when you're searching for a record label name or a band name or a zine name. When you figure it out, you're like, well, that's it. That's perfect.
Yeah.
And then, but these days you have to do a search on Instagram and Etsy to see, sure somebody's already named it that. Sure somebody's already taken that name. And they hadn't. So I was just like, fuck yes. So I made a brand and made packaging and started an Etsy store. And I've been selling product ever since. It was interesting though, because I was one of the first people in my apprenticeship of 22 people, I think it was. And this was the first time a herbalism apprenticeship had ever been offered in Southern California. I was like the guinea pig year. One of my friends in the group said to me, how did you figure this out? How did you come up with a name, come up with what you want your packaging to look like, print it, make an Etsy store? How did you do all this in 2 weeks? And I was just like, oh, that's because I'm a punk. That's because I've grown up doing it myself. Yeah. You know, I have this DIY ethic of, well, this is what you do. And we all learned to do things screen print shirts or Xerox a zine before there was YouTube, before there was the internet. So, you know, doing something now is really fucking easy because you can just look something up on YouTube.
Yeah.
That is actually the impetus for me wanting to write the book on Chicks Up Front and Hardcore Women from the 90s and the 80s, because I feel like all of the women that were heavily involved in the hardcore scene then have had this drive and this passion for their lives ever since then. And the theme of the book is, how has punk and hardcore changed your life, and how has it made you the person that you are now, and how do you think your life would be different if you'd never been involved in it? Because I think it definitely, made me who I am in terms of the DIY ethic, in terms of starting Punk Potions, and in terms of just being I don't know how to do that, but I'll figure it out. And I think that was such a great life lesson that we learned from punk in our teens that has had a huge impact in our life as adults. But Punk Potions it's basically a herbalism store where you can buy tinctures and salves and homemade deodorants. They're available on Etsy. I do herbalism consultations as well. I'm happy to recommend herbs to anybody. I don't really charge for it. I probably should. You know, my tinctures sell a little bit here and there on Etsy, and it's more just I have this library of medicine that sits in my office, and if I need it or anybody I know needs it, then it's there. And if somebody buys it on Etsy, great. But I don't really focus on it as a business the way I could or should. But, I work full time. I've got a house full of animals. I garden. I have a social life. There's only so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
I get more done than the average person because I chose not to have children, but there's still only X amount of hours in the day,
Yeah, I think that's perfect. It's like a motivational speech. The entire thing. Well, you want people to get inspired about shit.
I had to write the Rev 25 anniversary festival, which was an incredibly emotional weekend because so many bands did reunions for the first time. It was, when was it? 2012 or 2013? I don't remember. But around then, one of the things that I didn't have much responsibility except for pressing some records for it, like leading up to it. I didn't have much stress. The weekend itself was incredibly stressful, but also incredibly amazing. So one of the things that I did that Jordan didn't know about is months before it started, I contacted all of the bands, a lot of Jordan's friends, and a lot of the people that were on Revelation, a lot of the people in bands on Revelation. And I got them to send me a memory of when they found out they were being signed to Rev, when they first met Jordan, a funny story, photos. And I had it pulled together by the graphic designer at Rev into a 7x7 inch hardback book. And on the last day of Rev 25, I gave it to Jordan. And I'd spent the rest of that weekend getting all the people who hadn't submitted anything to write something in Jordan's book. So his was like totally personalized, and he was the happiest I think I've probably ever seen him when I gave him that book. He held on to it and he said, I've always wanted something like this to exist in the world, and now it does. But it was interesting that when I had to write the introduction to the book, and I wrote it and a couple of people read it and they were like, yeah, it's fine. But it didn't really have much emotion in it. And so I sat down again and wrote like a really emotional article about why I worked at Revelation and what Revelation had done to change my life. And I think that having that reflection and that appreciation for the label and for Jordan definitely helped me understand why I'm still doing this and why I'm still really motivated and why it still matters to me. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I got my citizenship 3 weeks ago. And Jordan was the first person I emailed to thank, because if Revelation hadn't sponsored me for my original visa and my original green card, then this wouldn't be my life. And I fucking love my life, you know? So, yeah, I owe a lot to Jordan and to Revelation. It was definitely a, you know, lots of ups and lots of downs over the course of 20 years, as one would expect. But, you know, as 2.5 years go by, you really only remember the good things, you know, the bad stuff starts to fade into oblivion. But I'm also, you know, very, very happy at Pirates Press Records. Skippy was my second email to thank for my citizenship because he financed it. I have a lot more autonomy, a lot more trust as the label manager at Pirates Press Records, and I really do appreciate that, and it makes my life, you know, there's a lot less stress in my life since I made the switch, and you know, that's a really great thing.